launch pad and ignited. It soared into the sky, turning the island below it into a green speck amid a vast blue expanse. In the control room, Musk paced as he watched the action, wearing shorts, flip-flops, and a t-shirt. Then, about 25 seconds in, it became clear that all was not well. A fire broke out above the Merlin engine, and suddenly, this machine that had been flying straight and true started to spin and then tumble uncontrollably back to Earth. The Falcon 1 ended up falling directly down onto the launch site. Most of the debris went into a reef 250 feet from the launch pad, and the satellite cargo smashed through SpaceX's machine shop roof and landed more or less intact on the floor. Some of the engineers put on their snorkeling and scuba gear and recovered the pieces, fitting all of the rocket's remnants into two refrigerator-sized crates. It is perhaps worth noting that those launch companies that succeeded also took their lumps along the way, Musk wrote in a postmortem. A friend of mine wrote to remind me that only 5 of the first 9 Pegasus launches succeeded. 3 of 5 for Ariane, 9 of 20 for Atlas, 9 of 21 for Soyuz, and 9 of 18 for Proton. Having experienced firsthand how hard it is to reach orbit, I have a lot of respect for those that persevered to produce the vehicles that are mainstays of space launch today. Musk closed the letter, writing, SpaceX is in this for the long haul, and, come hell or high water, we are going to make this work. Musk and other SpaceX executives blamed the crash on an unnamed technician. They said this technician had done some work on the rocket one day before the launch and failed to properly tighten a fitting on a fuel pipe, which caused the fitting to crack. The fitting in question was something basic, an aluminum B-nut that's often used to connect a pair of tubes. The technician was Holman. In the aftermath of the rocket crash, Holman flew to Los Angeles to confront Musk directly. He'd spent years working day and night on the Falcon 1 and felt enraged that Musk had called out him and his team in public. Holman knew that he'd fastened the B-nut correctly and that observers from NASA had been looking over his shoulder to check the work. When Holman charged into SpaceX's headquarters with a head full of fury, Mary Beth Brown tried to calm him and stop him from seeing Musk. Holman kept going anyway, and the two of them proceeded to have a shouting match at Musk's cubicle. After all the debris was analyzed, it turned out that the B-nut had almost certainly cracked due to corrosion from the months in Quadge's salty atmosphere. The rocket was literally crusted with salt on one side, and you had to scrape it off, Mueller said. But we had done a static fire 3 days earlier, and everything was fine. SpaceX had tried to save about 50 pounds of weight by using aluminum components instead of stainless steel. Thompson, the former Marine, had seen the aluminum parts work just fine in helicopters that sat on aircraft carriers, and Mueller had seen aircraft resting outside of Cape Canaveral for 40 years with aluminum B-nuts in fine condition. Years later, a number of SpaceX's executives still agonize over the way Holman and his team were treated. They were our best guys, and they kind of got blamed to get an answer out to the world, Mueller said. That was really bad. We found out later that it was dumb luck. Holman left the company after this incident in November 2007 and then returned for a spell to train new personnel. A number of people I interviewed for the book said that Holman was so key to SpaceX's early days that they feared the company might flame out without him. After the crash, there was a lot of drinking at a bar on the main island. Musk wanted to launch again within 6 months, but putting together a new machine would again require an immense amount of work. SpaceX had some pieces for the vehicle ready in El Segundo, but certainly not a ready-to-fire rocket. As they downed drinks, the engineers vowed to take a more disciplined approach with their next craft and to work better as a collective. Warden hoped the SpaceX engineers would raise their game as well. He'd been observing them for the Defense Department and loved the energy of the young engineers, but not their methodology. It was being done like a bunch of kids in Silicon Valley would do software, Warden said. They would stay up all night and try this and try that. I'd seen hundreds of these types of operations, and it struck me that it wouldn't work. Leading up to the first launch, Warden tried to caution Musk, sending a letter to him and the director of DARPA, the research arm of the Defense Department, that made his views clear. Elon didn't react well. He said, "What do you know? You're just an astronomer," Warden said. But after the rocket blew up, Musk recommended that Warden perform an investigation for the government. "I give Elon huge credit for that," Warden said. Almost exactly a year later, SpaceX was ready to try another launch. On March 15, 2007, a successful test fire took place. Then, on March 21st, the Falcon 1 finally behaved. From its launch pad surrounded by palm trees, the Falcon 1 surged up and toward space. It flew for a couple of minutes, with engineers now and again reporting that the systems were nominal or in good shape. At 3 minutes into the flight, the first stage of the rocket separated and fell back to Earth, and the Kestrel engine kicked in as planned to carry the second stage into orbit. Ecstatic cheers went out in the control room. Next, at the 4 minute mark, the fairing atop the rocket separated as planned. "It was doing exactly what it was supposed to do," said Mueller. "I was sitting next to Elon and looked at him and said, 'We've made it. We're hugging and believe it's going to make it to orbit.' Then it starts to wiggle." For more than 5 glorious minutes, the SpaceX engineers got to feel like they had done everything right. A camera on board the Falcon 1 pointed down and showed Earth getting smaller and smaller as the rocket made its way methodically into space. But then that wiggle that Mueller noticed turned into flailing, and the machine swooned, started to break apart, and then blew up. This time, the SpaceX engineers were quick to figure out what went wrong. As the propellant was consumed, what was left started to move around the tank and slosh against the sides, much like wine spinning around a glass. The sloshing propellant triggered the wobbling, and at one point it sloshed enough to leave an opening to the engine exposed. When the engine sucked in a big breath of air, it flamed out. The failure was another crushing blow to SpaceX's engineers. Some of them had spent close to 2 years shuffling back and forth between California, Hawaii, and Quaj. By the time SpaceX could attempt another launch, it would be about 4 years after Musk's original target, and the company had been chewing through his internet fortune at a worrying rate. Musk had vowed publicly that he would see this thing through to the end, but people inside and outside the company were doing back-of-the-envelope math and could tell that SpaceX likely could only afford one more attempt, maybe two. To the extent that the financial situation unnerved Musk, he rarely, if ever, let it show to employees. "Elon did a great job of not burdening people with those worries," said Spikes. "He always communicated the importance of being lean and of success, but it was never, 'If we fail, we're done for.' He was very optimistic." The failures seemed to do little to curtail Musk's vision for the future or raise doubts about his capabilities. In the midst of the chaos, he took a tour of the islands with Warden. Musk began thinking aloud about how the islands could be unified into one landmass. He suggested that walls could be built through the small channels between the islands, and the water could be pumped out, in the spirit of the man-made systems in the Netherlands. Warden, also known for his out-there ideas, was attracted to Musk's bravado. "But his thinking of this stuff is kind of cool," Warden said. From that point on, he and I discussed settling Mars. "It really impressed me that this is a guy that thinks big." Chapter 7. All Electric. J.B. Straubel has a 2-inch-long scar that cuts across the middle of his left cheek. He earned it in high school, during a chemistry class experiment. Straubel whipped up the wrong concoction of chemicals, and the beaker he was holding exploded, throwing off shards of glass, one of which sliced through his face. The wound lingers as a tinkerer's badge of honor. It arrived near the end of a childhood full of experimentation with chemicals and machines. Born in Wisconsin, Straubel constructed a large chemistry lab in the basement of his family's home that included fume hoods and chemicals ordered, borrowed, or pilfered. At 13, Straubel found an old golf cart at the dump. He brought it back home and restored it to working condition, which required him to rebuild the electric motor. It seemed that Straubel was always taking something apart, sprucing it up, and putting it back together. All of this fit into the Straubel family's do-it-yourself traditions. In the late 1890s, Straubel's great-grandfather started the Straubel Machine Company, which built one of the first internal combustion engines in the United States and used it to power boats. Straubel's inquisitive spirit carried him west to Stanford University, where he enrolled in 1994, intending to become a physicist. After flying through the hardest courses he could take, Straubel concluded that majoring in physics would not be for him. The advanced courses were too theoretical, and Straubel liked to get his hands dirty. He developed his own major called Energy Systems and Engineering. "I wanted to take software and electricity and use it to control energy," Straubel said. "It was computing combined with power electronics. I collected all the things I love doing in one place." There was no clean technology movement at this time, but there were companies dabbling with new uses for solar power and electric vehicles. Straubel ended up hunting down these startups, hanging out in their garages and pestering the engineers. He began tinkering once again on his own as well, in the garage of a house he shared with a half-dozen friends. Straubel bought a piece-of-shit Porsche for $1,600 and turned it into an electric car. This meant that Straubel had to create a controller to manage the electric motor, build a charger from scratch, and write the software that made the entire machine work. The car set the world record for electric vehicle, EV, acceleration, traveling a quarter mile in 17.28 seconds. "The thing I took away was that the electronics were great, and you could get acceleration on a shoestring budget, but the batteries sucked," Straubel said. "It had a 30-mile range, so I learned firsthand about some of the limitations of electric vehicles." Straubel gave his car a hybrid boost, building a gasoline-powered contraption that could be towed behind the Porsche and used to recharge the batteries. It was good enough for Straubel to drive the 400 miles down to Los Angeles and back. By 2002, Straubel was living in Los Angeles. He'd gotten a master's degree from Stanford and bounced around a couple of companies looking for something that called out to him. He decided on Rosen Motors, which had built one of the world's first hybrid vehicles, a car that ran off a flywheel and a gas turbine and had electric motors to drive the wheel. After it folded, Straubel followed Harold Rosen, an engineer famed for inventing the geostationary satellite, to create an electric plane. "I'm a pilot and love to fly, so this was perfect for me," Straubel said. The idea was that it would stay aloft for 2 weeks at a time and hover over a specific spot. This was way before drones and all that. To help make ends meet, Straubel also worked nights and on the weekend doing electronics consulting for a startup. It was in the midst of toiling away on all these projects that Straubel's old buddies from the Stanford Solar Car team came to pay him a visit. A group of rogue engineers at Stanford had been working on solar cars for years, building them in a World War II-era Quonset hut full of toxic chemicals and black widows. Unlike today, when the university would jump at the chance to support such a project, Stanford tried to shut down this group of fringe freaks and geeks. The students proved very capable of doing the work on their own and competed in cross-country solar-powered car races. Straubel helped build the vehicles during his time at university and even after, forming relationships with the incoming crop of engineers. The team had just raced 2,300 miles from Chicago to Los Angeles, and Straubel offered the strapped, exhausted kids a place to stay. About a half-dozen students showed up at Straubel's place, took their first showers in many days, and then spread across his floor. As they chatted late into the night, Strobel and the solar team kept fixating on one topic. They realized that lithium-ion batteries, such as the ones in their car being fed by the sun, had gotten much better than most people realized. Many consumer electronics devices, like laptops, were running on so-called 18650 lithium-ion batteries, which looked a lot like AA batteries and could be strung together. "We wondered what would happen if you put 10,000 of the battery cells together," Strobel said. "We did the math and figured you could go almost 1,000 miles. It was totally nerdy shit, and eventually everyone fell asleep. But the idea really stuck with me." Soon enough, Strobel was stalking the solar car crew, trying to talk them into building an electric car based on the lithium-ion batteries. He would fly up to Palo Alto, spend the night sleeping in his plane, and then ride a bicycle to the Stanford campus to make his sales pitch while helping with their current projects. The design Strobel had come up with was a super aerodynamic vehicle with 80% of its mass made up of the batteries. It looked quite a bit like a torpedo on wheels. No one knew the exact details of Strobel's long-term vision for this thing, including Strobel. The plan seemed to be less about forming a car company than about building a proof-of-concept vehicle just to get people thinking about the power of the lithium-ion batteries. With any luck, they would find a race to compete in. The Stanford students agreed to join Strobel if he could raise some money. He began going to trade shows, handing out brochures about his idea and emailing just about anyone he could think of. "I was shameless," he said. The only problem was that no one had any interest in what Strobel was selling. Investors dealt him one rejection after another for months on end. Then, in the fall of 2003, Strobel met Elon Musk. Harold Rosen had set up a lunch with Musk at a seafood restaurant near the SpaceX headquarters in Los Angeles and brought Strobel along to help talk up the electric plane idea. When Musk didn't bite on that, Strobel announced his electric car side project. The crazy idea struck an immediate chord with Musk, who had been thinking about electric vehicles for years. While Musk had mostly focused on using ultracapacitors for the vehicles, he was thrilled and surprised to hear how far the lithium-ion battery technology had progressed. "Everyone else had told me I was nuts, but Elon loved the idea," Strobel said. He said, "Sure, I will give you some money." Musk promised Strobel $10,000 of the $100,000 he was seeking. On the spot, Musk and Strobel formed a kinship that would survive more than a decade of extreme highs and lows as they set out to do nothing less than change the world. After the meeting with Musk, Strobel reached out to his friends at AC Propulsion. The Los Angeles-based company started in 1992 and was the bleeding edge of electric vehicles, building everything from zippy mid-size passenger jobs right on up to sports cars. Strobel really wanted to show Musk the T-Zero from T-Zero, the highest-end vehicle in AC Propulsion's stable. It was a type of kit car that had a fiberglass body sitting on top of a steel frame and went from 0 to 60 miles per hour in 4.9 seconds when first unveiled in 1997. Strobel had spent years hanging out with the AC Propulsion crew and asked Tom Gage, the company's president, to bring a T-Zero over for Musk to drive. Musk fell for the car. He saw its potential as a screaming fast machine that could shift the perception of electric cars from boring and plodding to something aspirational. For months, Musk offered to fund an effort to transform the kit car into a commercial vehicle, but got rebuffed time and again. "It was a proof of concept and needed to be made real," Strobel said. "I love the hell out of the AC Propulsion guys, but they were sort of hopeless at business and refused to do it. They kept trying to sell Elon on this car called the E-Box that looked like shit, didn't have good performance, and was just uninspiring." While the meetings with AC Propulsion didn't result in a deal, they had solidified Musk's interest in backing something well beyond Strobel's science project. In a late February 2004 email to Gage, Musk wrote, "What I'm going to do is figure out the best choice of a high-performance base car and electric powertrain and go in that direction." Unbeknownst to Straubel, at about the same time, a couple of business partners in Northern California had also fallen in love with the idea of making a lithium-ion battery-powered car. Martin Eberhard and Mark Tarpening had founded Nuvo Media in 1997 to create one of the earliest electronic book readers, called the Rocket eBook. The work at Nuvo Media had given the men insight into cutting-edge consumer electronics and the hugely improved lithium-ion batteries used to power laptops and other portable devices. While the Rocket eBook was too far ahead of its time and not a major commercial success, it was innovative enough to attract the attention of Gemstar International Group, which owned TV Guide and some electronic programming guide technology. Gemstar paid $187 million to acquire Nuvo Media in March 2000. Spoils in hand, the co-founders stayed in touch after the deal. They both lived in Woodside, one of the wealthiest towns in Silicon Valley, and chatted from time to time about what they should tackle next. "We thought up some goofball things," said Tarpening. "There was one plan for these fancy irrigation systems for farms, and the home based on smart water sensing networks. But nothing really resonated, and we wanted something more important." Eberhard was a supremely talented engineer with a do-gooder's social conscience. The United States' repeated conflicts in the Middle East bothered him. And like many other science-minded folks around 2000, he had started to accept global warming as a reality. Eberhard began looking for alternatives to gas-guzzling cars. He investigated the potential of hydrogen fuel cells, but found them lacking. He also didn't see much point in leasing something like the EV1 electric car from General Motors. What did catch Eberhard's interest, however, were the all-electric cars from AC Propulsion that he spied on the Internet. Eberhard went down to Los Angeles around 2001 to visit the AC Propulsion shop. "The place looked like a ghost town, and they were going out of business," Eberhard said. "I bailed them out with $500,000 so that they could build one of their cars for me with lithium-ion instead of lead-acid batteries." Eberhard, too, tried to goad AC Propulsion into being a commercial enterprise rather than a hobby shop. When they rejected his overtures, Eberhard decided to form his own company and see what the lithium-ion batteries could really do. Eberhard's journey began with him building a technical model of the electric car on a spreadsheet. This let him tweak various components and see how they might affect the vehicle's shape and performance. He could adjust the weight, number of batteries, resistance of the tires and body, and then get back answers on how many batteries it would take to power the various designs. The models made it clear that SUVs, which were very popular at the time, and things like delivery trucks, were unlikely candidates. The technology seemed instead to favor a lighter-weight, high-end sports car, which would be fast, fun to drive, and have far better range than most people would expect. These technical specifications complemented the findings of Tarpening, who had been doing research into a financial model for the car. The Toyota Prius had started to take off in California, and it was being purchased by wealthy eco-crusaders. "We also learned that the average income for EV1 owners was around $200,000 per year," Tarpening said. "People who used to go after the Lexus, BMW, and Cadillac brands saw electric and hybrid cars as a different kind of status symbol. The men figured they could build something for the $3 billion per year luxury auto market in the United States that would let rich people have fun and feel good about themselves, too. People pay for cool and sexy and an amazing 0-60 time," Tarpening said. On July 1, 2003, Eberhard and Tarpening incorporated their new company. While at Disneyland a few months earlier on a date with his wife, Eberhard had come up with the name Tesla Motors, both to pay homage to the inventor and electric motor pioneer Nikola Tesla, and because it sounded cool. The co-founders rented an office that had three desks and two small rooms in a decrepit 1960s building located at 845 Oak Grove Avenue in Menlo Park. The third desk was occupied a few months later by Ian Wright, an engineer who grew up on a farm in New Zealand. He was a neighbor of the Tesla co-founders in Woodside and had been working with them to hone his pitch for a networking startup. When the startup failed to raise any money from venture capitalists, Wright joined Tesla. As the three men began to tell some of their confidants of their plans, they were confronted with universal derision. "We met a friend at this Woodside pub to tell her what we had finally decided to do and that it was going to be an electric car," Tarpening said. She said, "You have to be kidding me."
Anyone who tries to build a car company in the United States is quickly reminded that the last successful startup in the industry was Chrysler, founded in 1925. Designing and building a car from the ground up comes with plenty of challenges, but it's really getting the money and know-how to build lots of cars that has thwarted past efforts to get a new company going. The Tesla founders were aware of these realities. They figured that Nikola Tesla had built an electric motor a century earlier, and that creating a drivetrain to take the power from the motor and send it to the wheels was doable. The really frightening part of their enterprise would be building the factory to make the car and its associated parts. But the more the Tesla guys researched the industry, the more they realized that the big automakers don't even really build their cars anymore. The days of Henry Ford having raw materials delivered to one end of his Michigan factory and then sending cars out the other end had long passed. BMW didn't make its windshields or upholstery or rearview mirrors, Tarpening said. The only thing the big car companies had kept was internal combustion research, sales and marketing, and the final assembly. We thought naively that we could access all the same suppliers for our parts. The plan that Tesla co-founders came up with was to license some technology from AC Propulsion around the T-Zero vehicle and to use the Lotus Elise chassis for the body of their car. Lotus, the English car maker, had released the two-door Elise in 1996, and it certainly had the sleek, ground-hugging appeal to make a statement to high-end car buyers. After talking to a number of people in the car dealership business, the Tesla team decided to avoid selling their cars through partners and sell direct. With these basics of a plan in place, the three men went hunting for some venture capital funding in January 2004. To make things feel more real for the investors, the Tesla founders borrowed a T-Zero from AC Propulsion and drove it to the venture capital corridor of Sand Hill Road. The car accelerated faster than a Ferrari, and this translated into visceral excitement for the investors. The downside, though, was that venture capitalists are not a terribly imaginative bunch, and they struggled to see past the crappy plastic finish of this glorified kit car. The only venture capitalists that bit were Compass Technology Partners and SDL Ventures, and they didn't sound altogether thrilled. The lead partner at Compass had made out well on Nouveau Media and felt some loyalty to Eberhard and Tarpening. He said, "This is stupid, but I've invested in every automotive startup for the last 40 years, so why not?" Tarpening recalled. Tesla still needed a lead investor who would pony up the bulk of the $7 million needed to make what's known as a mule or a prototype vehicle. That would be their first milestone and give them something physical to show off, which could aid a second round of funding. Eberhard and Tarpening had Elon Musk's name in the back of their heads as a possible lead investor from the outset. They had both seen him speak a couple of years earlier at a Mars Society conference held at Stanford, where Musk had laid out his vision of sending mice into space, and they got the impression that he thought a bit differently and would be open to the idea of an electric car. The idea to pitch Musk on Tesla Motors solidified when Tom Gage from AC Propulsion called Eberhard and told him that Musk was looking to fund something in the electric car arena. Eberhard and Wright flew down to Los Angeles and met with Musk on a Friday. That weekend, Musk peppered Tarpening, who had been away on a trip, with questions about the financial model. "I just remember responding, responding, and responding," Tarpening said. The following Monday, Martin and I flew down to meet him again, and he said, "Okay, I'm in." The Tesla founders felt like they had lucked into the perfect investor. Musk had the engineering smarts to know what they were building. He also shared their larger goal of trying to end the United States' addiction to oil. You need angel investors to have some belief, and it wasn't a purely financial transaction for him, Tarpenning said. He wanted to change the energy equation of the country. With an investment of $6.5 million, Musk had become the largest shareholder of Tesla and the chairman of the company. Musk would later wield his position of strength well while battling Eberhard for control of Tesla. It was a mistake, Eberhard said. I wanted more investors, but if I had to do it again, I would take his money. A bird in the hand, you know. We needed it. Not long after this meeting took place, Musk called Straubel and urged him to meet with the Tesla team. Straubel heard that their offices in Menlo Park were about a half a mile away from his house, and he was intrigued but very skeptical of their story. No one on the planet was more dialed in to the electric vehicle scene than Straubel, and he found it hard to believe that a couple of guys had gotten this far along without word of their project reaching him. Nonetheless, Straubel stopped by the office for a meeting and was hired right away in May 2004 at a salary of $95,000 per year. I told them that I had been building the battery pack they need down the street with funding from Elon, Straubel said. We agreed to join forces and formed this ragtag group. Had anyone from Detroit stopped by Tesla Motors at this point, they would have ended up in hysterics. The sum total of the company's automotive expertise was that a couple of the guys at Tesla really liked cars, and another one had created a series of science fair projects based on technology that the automotive industry considered ridiculous. What's more, the founding team had no intention of turning to Detroit for advice on how to build a car company. No, Tesla would do what every other Silicon Valley startup had done before it, which was hire a bunch of young, hungry engineers and figure things out as they went along. Never mind that the Bay Area had no real history of this model ever having worked for something like a car, and that building a complex, physical object had little in common with writing a software application. What Tesla did have, ahead of anyone else, was the realization that the 18650 lithium-ion batteries had gotten really good and were going to keep getting better. Hopefully that, coupled with some effort and smarts, would be enough. Straubel had a direct pipeline into the smart, energetic engineers at Stanford and told them about Tesla. Gene Berdichevsky, one of the members of the solar-powered car team, lit up the second he heard from Straubel. An undergraduate, Berdichevsky volunteered to quit school, work for free, and sweep the floors at Tesla, if that's what it took to get a job. The founders were impressed with his spirit and hired Berdichevsky after one meeting. This left Berdichevsky in the uncomfortable position of calling his Russian immigrant parents, a pair of nuclear submarine engineers, to tell them that he was giving up on Stanford to join an electric car startup. As employee number 7, he spent part of the workday in the Menlo Park office and the rest in Straubel's living room, designing three-dimensional models of the car's powertrain on a computer and building battery pack prototypes in the garage. Only now do I realize how insane it was, Berdichevsky said. Tesla soon needed to expand to accommodate its budding engineer army and to create a workshop that would help bring the Roadster, as they were now calling the car, to life. They found a two-story industrial building in San Carlos at 1050 Commercial Street. The 10,000-square-foot facility wasn't much, but it had room to build a research and development shop capable of knocking out some prototype cars. There were a couple of large assembly bays on the right side of the building and two large roll-up doors big enough for cars to drive in and out. Wright divided the open floor space into segments: motors, batteries, power electronics, and final assembly. The left half of the building was an office space that had been modified in weird ways by the previous tenant, a plumbing supply company. The main conference room had a wet bar and a sink where the faucet was a swan's mouth, and the hot and cold knobs were wings. Berdichevsky painted the office white on a Sunday night, and the next week the employees made a field trip to IKEA to buy desks and hopped online to order their computers from Dell. As for tools, Tesla had a single Craftsman toolbox loaded with hammers, nails, and other carpentry basics. Musk would visit now and again from Los Angeles and was unfazed by the conditions, having seen SpaceX grow up in similar surroundings. The original plan for producing a prototype vehicle sounded simple. Tesla would take the AC propulsion T0 powertrain and fit it into the Lotus Elise body. The company had acquired a schematic for an electric motor design and figured it could buy a transmission from a company in the United States or Europe and outsource any other parts from Asia. Tesla's engineers mostly needed to focus on developing the battery pack systems, wiring the car, and cutting and welding metal as needed to bring everything together. Engineers loved to muck around with hardware, and the Tesla team thought of the Roadster as something akin to a car conversion project that could be done with two or three mechanical engineers and a few assembly people. The main team of prototype builders consisted of Straubel, Berdichevsky, and David Lyons, a very clever mechanical engineer and employee number 12. Lyons had about a decade of experience working for Silicon Valley companies and had met Straubel a few years before when the two men struck up a conversation at a 7-Eleven about an electric bike Straubel was riding. Lyons had helped Straubel pay bills by hiring him as a consultant for a company building a device to measure people's core body temperature. Straubel thought he could return the favor by bringing Lyons on early to such an exciting project. Tesla would benefit in a big way as well. As Berdichevsky put it, Dave Lyons knew how to get shit done. The engineers bought a blue lift for the car and set it up inside the building. They also purchased some machine tools, hand tools, and floodlights to work at night, and started to turn the facility into a hotbed of R&D activity. Electrical engineers studied the Lotus's base-level software to figure out how it tied together the pedals, mechanical apparatus, and the dashboard gauges. The really advanced work took place with the battery pack design. No one had ever tried to combine hundreds of lithium-ion batteries in parallel, so Tesla ended up at the cutting edge of the technology. The engineers started trying to understand how heat would dissipate and current flow would behave across 70 batteries by supergluing them together into groups called bricks. Then 10 bricks would be placed together, and the engineers would test various types of air and liquid cooling mechanisms. When the Tesla team had developed a workable battery pack, they stretched the yellow Lotus Elise chassis 5 inches and lowered the pack with a crane into the back of the car, where its engine would normally be. These efforts began in earnest on October 18, 2004, and, rather remarkably, 4 months later, on January 27, 2005, an entirely new kind of car had been built by 18 people. It could even be driven around. Tesla had a board meeting that day, and Musk zipped about in the car. He came away happy enough to keep investing. Musk put in $9 million more as Tesla raised a $13 million funding round. The company now planned to deliver the Roadster to consumers in early 2006. Once they'd finished building a second car a few months later, the engineers at Tesla decided they needed to face up to a massive potential flaw in their electric vehicle. On July 4, 2005, they were at Eberhard's house in Woodside celebrating Independence Day and figured it was as good a moment as any to see what happened when the Roadster's batteries caught on fire. Someone taped 20 of the batteries together, put a heating strip wire into the bundle, and set it off. "It went up like a cluster of bottle rockets," Lyons said. Instead of 20 batteries, the Roadster would have close to 7,000, and the thought of what an explosion at that scale would be like horrified the engineers. One of the perks of an electric car was meant to be that it moved people away from a flammable liquid like gasoline and the endless explosions that take place in an engine. Rich people were unlikely to pay a high price for something even more dangerous, and the early nightmare scenario for the employees at Tesla was that a rich, famous person would get caught in a fire caused by the car. "It was one of those, oh shit, moments," Lyons said. "That is when we really sobered up." Tesla formed a 6-person task force to deal with the battery issue. they were pulled off all other work and given money to begin running experiments. The first explosions started taking place at the Tesla headquarters, where the engineers filmed them in slow motion. Once saner minds prevailed, Tesla moved its explosion research to a blast area behind an electrical substation maintained by the fire department. Blast by blast, the engineers learned a great deal about the inner workings of the batteries. They developed methods for arranging them in ways that would prevent fires spreading from one battery to the next, and other techniques for stopping explosions altogether. Thousands of batteries exploded along the way, and the effort was worth it. It was still early days, for sure, but Tesla was on the verge of inventing battery technology that would set it apart from rivals for years to come and would become one of the company's great advantages. The early success at building two prototype cars, coupled with Tesla's engineering breakthroughs around the batteries and other technological pieces, boosted the company's confidence. It was time to put Tesla's stamp on the vehicle. The original plan had been to do the bare minimum we could get away with as far as making the car stylistically different from a Lotus, but electric, said Tarpaning. Along the way, Elon and the rest of the board said, "You only get to do this once. It has to delight the customer, and the Lotus just isn't good enough to do that." The Elise's chassis, or base frame, worked fine for Tesla's engineering purposes. But the body of the car had serious issues in both form and function. The door on the Elise was all of a foot tall, and you were meant to either jump into the car or fall into it, depending on your flexibility and or dignity. The body also needed to be longer to accommodate Tesla's battery pack and a trunk. And Tesla preferred to make the Roadster out of carbon fiber instead of fiberglass. On these design points, Musk had a lot of opinion and influence. He wanted a car that Justine could feel comfortable getting into and that had some measure of practicality. Musk made these opinions clear when he visited Tesla for board meetings and design reviews. Tesla hired a handful of designers to mock up new looks for the Roadster. After settling on a favorite, the company paid to build a quarter-scale model of the vehicle in January 2005 and then a full-scale model in April. This process provided the Tesla executives with yet another revelation of everything that went into making a car. They wrap this shiny Mylar material around the model and vacuum it so that you can really see the contours and shine and shadows, Tarpaning said. The silver model was then turned into a digital rendering that the engineers could manipulate on their computers. A British company took the digital file and used it to create a plastic version of the car called an Aerobuck for aerodynamics testing. They put it on a boat and shipped it to us, and then we took it to Burning Man, Tarpaning said, referring to the annual drug-infused art festival held in the Nevada desert. About a year later, after many tweaks and much work, Tesla had a pencils-down moment. It was May 2006, and the company had grown to 100 employees. This team built a black version of the Roadster known as EP1, or Engineering Prototype 1. It was saying, "We now think we know what we will build," Tarpaning said. "You can feel it. It's a real car, and it's very exciting." The arrival of the EP1 provided a great excuse to show existing investors what their money had bought and to ask for more funds from a wider audience. The venture capitalists were impressed enough to overlook the fact that engineers sometimes had to manually fan the car to cool it down in between test drives, and were now starting to grasp Tesla's long-term potential. Musk once again put money into Tesla, $12 million, and a handful of other investors, including the venture capital firm Draper Fisher Jurvetson, Vantage Point Capital Partners, J.P. Morgan, Compass Technology Partners, Nick Pritzker, Larry Page, and Sergey Brin joined the $40 million round. In a press release announcing the funding round, Musk was not listed as a founder of the company. In the About Tesla Motors section, the company stated, "Tesla Motors was founded in June 2003 by Martin Eberhard and Mark Tarpaning to create efficient electric cars for people who love to drive." Musk and Eberhard would later spar over Musk's founder status. In July 2006, Tesla decided to tell the world what it had been up to. The company's engineers had built a red prototype, EP2, to complement the black one, and they both went on display at an event in Santa Clara. The press flocked to the announcement and were quite taken with what they saw. The Roadsters were gorgeous two-seater convertibles that could go from 0 to 60 in about 4 seconds. "Until today," Musk said at the event, "all electric cars have sucked." Celebrities like then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former Disney CEO Michael Eisner showed up at the event, and many of them took test rides in the Roadsters. The vehicles were so fragile that only Straubel and a couple of other trusted hands knew how to run them, and they were swapped out every 5 minutes to avoid overheating. Tesla revealed that each car would cost about $90,000 and had a range of 250 miles per charge. 30 people, the company said, had committed to buying a Roadster, including the Google co-founders Brin and Page and a handful of other technology billionaires. Musk promised that a cheaper car, a four-seat, four-door model under $50,000, would arrive in about 3 years. Around the time of this event, Tesla made its debut in the New York Times via a mini profile on the company. Eberhard vowed, optimistically, to begin shipments of the Roadster in the middle of 2007, instead of early 2006, as once planned, and laid out Tesla's strategy of starting with a high-priced, low-volume product and moving down to more affordable products over time, as underlying technology and manufacturing capabilities advanced. Musk and Eberhard were big believers in this strategy, having seen it play out with a number of electronic devices. Cell phones, refrigerators, color TVs, they didn't start off by making a low-end product for masses, Eberhard told the paper. They were relatively expensive for people who could afford it. While the story was a coup for Tesla, Musk didn't appreciate being left out of the article entirely. "We tried to emphasize him and told the reporter about him over and over again, but they weren't interested in the board of the company," Tarpaning said. Elon was furious. He was livid. You could understand why Musk might want some of the shine of Tesla to rub off on him. The car had turned into a cause célèbre of the automotive world. Electric vehicles tended to invoke religious overreactions from both the pro and con camps, and the appearance of a good-looking, fast electric car stoked everyone's passions. Tesla had also turned Silicon Valley into a real threat, at least conceptually, to Detroit for the first time. The month after the Santa Monica event was the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance, a famous showcase for exotic cars. Tesla had become such a topic of conversation that the organizers of the event begged to have a Roadster and waived the usual display fees. Tesla set up a booth, and people showed up by the dozens writing $100,000 checks on the spot to pre-order their cars. "This was long before Kickstarter, and we just had not thought of trying to do that," Tarpaning said. "But then we started getting millions of dollars at these types of events." Venture capitalists, celebrities, and friends of Tesla employees began trying to buy their way onto the waiting list. Some of Silicon Valley's wealthy elite went so far as to show up at the Tesla office and knock on the door, looking to buy a car. The entrepreneurs Konstantin Othmer and Bruce Leake, who had known Musk from his internship days at Rocket Science Games, did just that one weekday, and ended up getting a personal tour of the car from Musk and Eberhard that stretched over a couple of hours. "At the end we said, 'We'll take one,'" Othmer said. "They weren't actually allowed to sell cars yet, though, so we joined their club. It cost $100,000, but one of the benefits of membership was that you'd get a free car." As Tesla switched from marketing back into R&D mode, it had some trends working in its favor. Advances in computing had made it so that small car companies could sometimes punch at the same weight as the giants of the industry. Years ago, automakers would have needed to make a fleet of cars for crash testing.
Tesla could not afford to do that, and it didn't have to. The third Roadster engineering prototype went to the same collision testing facility used by large automakers, giving Tesla access to top-of-the-line high-speed cameras and other imaging technology. Thousands of other tests, though, were done by a third party that specialized in computer simulations and saved Tesla from building a fleet of crash vehicles. Tesla also had equal access to the big guy's durability tracks, made out of cobblestones and concrete embedded with metal objects. It could replicate 100,000 miles and 10 years of wear at these facilities. Quite often, the Tesla engineers brought their Silicon Valley attitude to the automaker's traditional stomping grounds. There's a brake and traction testing track in northern Sweden near the Arctic Circle, where cars get tuned on large planes of ice. It would be standard to run the car for 3 days or so, get the data, and return to company headquarters for many weeks of meetings about how to adjust the car. The whole process of tuning a car can take the entire winter. Tesla, by contrast, sent its engineers along with the Roadsters being tested and had them analyze the data on the spot. When something needed to be tweaked, the engineers would rewrite some code and send the car back on the ice. BMW would need to have a confab between three or four companies that would all blame each other for the problem, Tarpening said. We just fixed it ourselves. Another testing procedure required that the Roadsters go into a special cooling chamber to check how they would respond to frigid temperatures. Not wanting to pay the exorbitant costs to use one of these chambers, the Tesla engineers opted to rent an ice cream delivery truck with a large refrigerated trailer. Someone would drive a Roadster into the truck, and the engineers would don parkas and work on the car. Every time Tesla interacted with Detroit, it received a reminder of how the once great city had been separated from its own can-do culture. Tesla tried to lease a small office in Detroit. The costs were incredibly low compared with space in Silicon Valley, but the city's bureaucracy made getting just a basic office an ordeal. The building's owner wanted to see 7 years of audited financials from Tesla, which was still a private company. Then the building owner wanted 2 years' worth of advanced rent. Tesla had about $50 million in the bank and could have bought the building outright. In Silicon Valley, you say you're backed by a venture capitalist, and that's the end of the negotiation, Tarpening said. But everything was like that in Detroit. We'd get FedEx boxes, and they couldn't even decide who should sign for the package. Throughout these early years, the engineers credited Eberhard with making quick, crisp decisions. Rarely did Tesla get hung up over analyzing a situation. The company would pick a plan of attack, and when it failed at something, it failed fast and then tried a new approach. It was many of the changes that Musk wanted that started to delay the Roadster. Musk kept pushing for the car to be more comfortable, asking for alterations to the seats and the doors. He made the carbon fiber body a priority, and he pushed for electronic sensors on the doors so that the Roadster could be unlocked with a touch of a finger instead of a tug on a handle. Eberhard groused that these features were slowing the company down, and many of the engineers agreed. It felt at times like Elon was this unreasonably demanding, overarching force, said Berdichevsky. The company as a whole was sympathetic to Martin, because he was there all the time, and we all felt the car should ship sooner. By the middle of 2007, Tesla had grown to 260 employees and seemed to be pulling off the impossible. It had produced the fastest, most beautiful electric car the world had ever seen, almost from thin air. All it had to do next was build a lot of the cars, a process that would end up almost bankrupting the company. The greatest mistake Tesla's executives made in the early days were assumptions around the transmission system for the Roadster. The goal had always been to get from 0 to 60 miles per hour as quickly as possible, in the hopes that the raw speed of the Roadster would attract a lot of attention and make it fun to drive. To do this, Tesla's engineers had decided on a two-speed transmission, which is the underlying mechanism in the car for transferring power from the motor to the wheels. The first gear would take the car from 0 to 60 miles per hour in less than 4 seconds, and then the second gear would take the car up to 130 miles per hour. Tesla had hired Xtrak, a British company specializing in transmission designs, to build this part, and had every reason to believe that this would be one of the smoother bits of the Roadster's journey. "People had been making transmissions since Robert Fulton built the steam engine," said Bill Curry, a veteran Silicon Valley engineer and employee number 86 at Tesla. "We thought you would just order one, but the first one we had lasted 40 seconds. The initial transmission could not handle the big jump from the first to the second gear, and the fear was that the second gear would engage at high speed and not be synchronized with the motor properly, which would result in catastrophic damage to the car." Lyons and the other engineers quickly set out to try to fix the issue. They found a couple of other contractors to design replacements and again hoped that these long-time transmission experts would deliver something usable with relative ease. It soon became apparent, however, that the contractors were not always putting their A-team to work on this project for a tiny startup in Silicon Valley, and that the new transmissions were no better than the first. During tests, Tesla found that the transmissions would sometimes break after 150 miles, and that the mean time between failures was about 2,000 miles. When a team from Detroit ran a root cause analysis of the transmission to find failures, they discovered 14 separate issues that could cause the system to break. Tesla had wanted to deliver the Roadster in November 2007, but the transmission issues lingered, and by the time January 1, 2008 rolled around, the company had to once again start from scratch on a third transmission push. Tesla also faced issues abroad. The company had decided to send a team of its youngest, most energetic engineers to Thailand to set up a battery factory. Tesla partnered with an enthusiastic, although not totally capable, manufacturing partner. The Tesla engineers had been told that they could fly over and manage the construction of a state-of-the-art battery factory. Instead of a factory, they found a concrete slab with posts holding up a roof. The building was about a 3-hour drive south from Bangkok, and had been left mostly open, like many of the other factories, because of the incredible heat. The other manufacturing operations dealt with making stoves, tires, and commodities that could withstand the elements. Tesla had sensitive batteries and electronics, and, like parts of the Falcon 1, they'd be chewed up by the salty, humid conditions. Eventually, Tesla's partner paid about $75,000 to put in drywall, coat the floor, and create storage rooms with temperature controls. Tesla's engineers ended up working maddening hours trying to train the Thai workers on how to handle the electronics properly. The development of the battery technology, which had once moved along at a rapid pace, slowed to a crawl. The battery factory was one part of a supply chain that stretched across the globe, adding cost and delays to the Roadster production. Body panels for the car were to be made in France, while the motors were to come from Taiwan. Tesla planned on buying battery cells in China and shipping them to Thailand to turn the piece parts into battery packs. The battery packs, which had to be stored for a minimal amount of time to avoid degradation, would then be taken to port and shipped to England, where they needed to clear customs. Tesla then planned for Lotus to build the body of the car, attach the battery packs, and ship the Roadsters by boat around Cape Horn to Los Angeles. In that scenario, Tesla would have paid for the bulk of the car and had no chance to recognize revenue on the parts until 6 to 9 months had passed. The idea was to get to Asia, get things done fast and cheap, and make money on the car, said Forrest North, one of the engineers sent to Thailand. What we found out was that for really complicated things, you can do the work cheaper here and have less delays and less problems. When some new hires came on, they were horrified to discover just how haphazard Tesla's plan appeared. Ryan Popple, who had spent 4 years in the Army and then gotten an MBA from Harvard, arrived at Tesla as a director of finance meant to prep the company to go public. After examining the company's books early in his tenure, Popple asked the manufacturing and operations head exactly how he would get the car made.
He said, "Well, we will decide we're going into production, and then a miracle is going to happen," Popple said.
As word of the manufacturing issues reached Musk, he became very concerned about the